from the heart of Dubai, where tomorrow is being built today to the world. Welcome to the CTO Show with Mehmet. Here, we redefine technology and reimagine possibilities. With Mehmet, delve into the riveting realms of AI, cybersecurity, and digital technology. Experience the thrilling highs and lows of startups. Immerse yourself in the spirit of entrepreneurship and witness the future of business innovation being written in real time. Now, without further ado, let's tune in and explore the future.
Hello and welcome back to a new episode of the CTO Show with Mehmet. Today, I'm very pleased welcoming Sean joining me from Canada. Sean is the CEO of Outforce.ai. Sean, the way I love to do it, as I was explaining to you previously, I keep it to my guests to introduce themselves because of a theory I have. The best one who can introduce himself or herself is the person, himself or herself. So the floor is yours.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Mehmet. Yeah. I'm just a guy who likes to solve business problems and enable those solutions with technology. And I've done it four times with tech companies. Now every time I've built a tech company, I've hit an inflection point where I've had to outsource something. And as a result, I've had to have the opposite problem of outsourcing, of hiring engineers, which is outsourcing has too many options. So this time I decided to build a solution to that and build a filter to help companies get better matched with outsourcing agencies. And that's what Outforce is.
That's great, Sean. And of course, we're going to discuss a lot about this topic today. But of course, like anything, you know, when you start a business, when you decide to solve a business problem, as you said,
yeah,
you must have spot some patterns, some challenges, some common problems when it comes to this. But what was the moment that triggered you, Sean, and you've been a tech entrepreneur for a long time? You said, okay, you know what? I think I can solve this problem. But let's discuss first how you came up with the idea that, okay, now is the right moment because I'm going to solve these challenges.
Oh, it depends. And there have been very different businesses that I've been in. And I have no expertise in the business, which is probably part of the problem that I have. I see where the holes are based on my own experience and try and fill it, and either with a service or a technology. And that has been successful a couple of times and unsuccessful a couple of times. Like I say, being from Canada, I can say this, that all of my businesses have gone south. Some of them have gone to the United States, which means they've been successful. But I think it's, first, you have an idea, then you have to figure out whether you've got a product market fit, because your idea as it initiates will never be the same as what is actually what the market wants. So you look at anything like Y Combinator or any of the startup accelerators, they tell you, go talk to customers, figure out what they want. And one of my first businesses is funny enough, everybody told me it was what they wanted, until somebody told me it was the stupidest idea he's ever heard. And he was one of those people that were the right customer profile. And I said, well, why are you saying that? Because everyone else is saying it's a great idea. And he told me the real reason, the things that people weren't saying. And sometimes you need to listen to that off one instead of say, oh, this guy doesn't know what he's talking about. And that really helped because I ended up landing the perfect business in that case.
That's great story actually, Sean. Now, you know, let's discuss, you know, a little bit, you know, the background of the problem you're trying to solve today. So,
yeah,
you must have seen, you know, some common, as I said, mistakes that usually founders, especially maybe first time founders, they fall in when they are trying to get something to an outsourced agency. So, like, what are these common mistakes you've seen, and, you know, from your experience, how they can avoid falling in that trap?
Well, I mean, people outsource for a whole bunch of different reasons, some of which I might have mentioned, where you're growing fast and you need more engineers than you can hire at a certain pace, or you've got a trade show, you need something ready for the show, you've got a big account and they need a front end that matches theirs and APIs into their systems. So those, you know, those are not really core engineering functionalities. And so those are generally the ones that are outsourced. In the case of a startup, you know, when I did my first startup, you wouldn't even think of outsourcing because it was in the 90s and you would have enough engineers around. Now, good engineers are all distributed and not, and they're pretty hard to find, even harder to bring them into a new company. And so that's why you would outsource something at the beginning. Another reason to outsource something at the very beginning, and you mentioned startups specifically, so I'll answer that question, is, you know, you, like I said, you don't have product market fit until you've had it tested with maybe 100 customers. And so the person that you may be a friend with who could, you could bootstrap and build some product, might be good for that start to get to where you're going to figure out that what you're building is actually, you know, if it had this, we would do it kind of thing. And you have to rebuild something that's adjacent to what you're building. But often you'll get to a certain point where the engineer you started with is not the one that's going to take you to the accelerated growth or the scalability that you need. Just because it's your friend, it's not a good reason to be your lead engineer. Or just because that person is good and available is not the reason to be the lead engineer. Because what you end up doing, because you're kind of low on cash, is you'll give that person a big chunk of the company. And then you have that really tough conversation later in the business cycle where it's not working out. And, you know, it's spaghetti code, or, you know, it was really good for a while, but it's not going to be good enough to go in the future. Or you get investors who are starting to tell you how to do your business, which often happens with venture capital. And they want somebody else to come in and do things. So you have these really difficult conversations. So if you could prepare for that in advance and just find friends and family to get the money, to get some third party firm that has no vested interest in your company, but is good to build your proof of concept product, which today is not a very expensive venture, you know, with Copilot and everything else going on in the development world, you can quickly wrap up a prototype of what you're trying to access, even just with Figma showing clickable screens, to validate whether it's something that people would actually use and want before you actually start really investing in product engineering teams. So it saves you a lot of trouble downstream if you can avoid giving up equity and major commitments to your co-founding engineer. And that's a terrible thing to say to a lot of your audience who are engineers, but a lot of engineers are starting their own company as well. So who you bring on your own team makes a big difference as well. That's where I'd say it.
Now, Sean, I get your point, but do you think that this applies to certain type of founders, or even, you know, even if you're talking about normal company? Because if the founders are technical, right?
Yes.
Yeah. If the founders are technical, so maybe they can do some of the tasks themselves. Oh, yeah.
Exactly.
Because you know, like one of the things I've been lucky enough, especially in the last year, to also sit on calls with investors, right? And these guys usually they look on to the founding team, and yep. You know, they look to these people who are coming to them pitch their ideas. Now, does it matter, for example, if we have, let's say, a non-technical founder plus a technical founder versus maybe two non-technical founders who are trying to get, they have a brilliant idea, but they need someone to build it from the ground? And maybe it's a loaded question, I know. And does this apply only for engineering, or also applies for other things also as well? Like, I don't know, maybe...
A lot of things. Go to
market. Office yeah. Task, marketing, sales, whatever. Yeah. So yeah. what's your take on this?
Yeah. So traditionally engineering is the moat that you have as a defense for your company. I guess that's the point I'm trying to say is that, for what I just described, for a technical founder, no. If you're an engineer and you're the founder of a company, great, go for it, build what you want. And you probably are the best to assess what kind of a team you want to have around you. You know, good engineers are very flexible in terms of what they can build if they have a good engineering mindset. But a non-technical founder should be very wary about giving a big chunk of the company to a technical co-founder without having done a previous company with that technical co-founder and knowing how far that person can go. To your point, for the technical founder, I would say today, and any founder for that matter, your technical moat has disappeared. There's just so much speed in the ability to deliver engineered product now with AI that if you get funding, anyone who is adjacent to you in that market but was not hitting the sweet spot that you think needed to be filled can easily move into your market and rebuild or reverse engineer what you're building and take away your market with more money and more horsepower. So speed and go to market is today probably the more important co-founder or equally important co-founder to the engineering.
Great. I get the point, Sean. Now, of course, here I'm not trying to challenge as I'm trying.
Yeah, no, I love it.
No, so because what I try to do is I want to convey a message, but I prefer that this message comes out from the expert, which is you in this case. Now,
go ahead. I love what you said was absolutely true.
Yeah.
So I welcome.
Yeah. So the other thing that usually happens, Sean, now, actually, it's happened with someone close to me. So they were discussing some ideas. They have some technology background, but they cannot write code themselves, right? And they don't understand anything about coding, but they have the technical knowledge. They know, like, of course, what is back end, what's front end, and so on. Now, one of the guys, you know, the question that came to his mind is, hey, okay, fine. Now, we can bring someone outsourced to do this, but what if this guy take our idea because he's not our employee and, you know, he give it to someone else or he go and build it himself? And the other thing, okay, of course, there was discussion. We can sign NDAs and we can do this, we can do that. And he said, okay, if you outsource to a place and the guy is living in, you know, in somewhere in the world, maybe in Southeast Asia, maybe in South America, maybe even in the
US.
Doesn't
matter. Anybody can do it.
Right? So how, with this, you know, very open world, I would say, but yet still you have the distances, how you can control this, Sean? Like, especially for founders who might be not sure if, you know, this is the best approach for them.
Okay. So that goes back to your very first question, which is what are the mistakes in outsourcing? And most people, I'll answer your question directly first, then I'll go backwards up to what I should have answered the first time. To answer your question, you should look at how, if it's an individual, we really don't have a lot of control because an individual will do what an individual does based on their character. So it's better to go with an outsourced agency that wants to stay in business for a long time because most agencies are in the business of providing engineering services as a business. They are not in the business of stealing their clients' ideas and making a new product. And the advantage that they have, especially if you choose the right one, so you want to look for that they've been in business for a bunch of years and they've got a good client roster to prove that they're not going to steal your idea, right? The second thing is you want to look at the company actually having engineers that have done products in a similar space to what you're doing. Because this is your first time trying that thing. Let's say it's in health tech. And you may know something about what the health tech sector needs in your domain, but you don't know what else is going on. And it really helps to have somebody who's built a lot of health tech products because they understand rules and regulations around HIPAA and EMRs. They understand the business and the workflow of a hospital or a healthcare facility. And so they understand user experiences in ways that you may not know and the technical and legal requirements of those user experiences. So you get a lot more from an engineering team that has been in the space and built similar products And that's the advantage of the risk, right? The risk is, oh, these guys are going to run away with my product. No, they may use some of the knowledge that they've gained from working with you, as they have with other clients, to the advantage of accelerating your product. So that's, so in terms of answering your question, do the due diligence on the company. Make sure it's, you're not dealing with just an individual contractor on Upwork who could run off, and you're right, think it's a great idea because they've got nothing to lose. But a company with, you know, 50 engineers is not going to want to go and steal your product.
Great. And thank you for mentioning, you know, the part of Upwork, because this was my next question. And maybe here you can explain, if you can explain, Sean, to us, like, how exactly you help, you know, companies in this part. Because, again, I'm taking a scenario. I'm a guy. I have no background. I have the idea. I validated it somehow, let's say, maybe by asking friends. And I know, like, if I build this, an MVP, you know, I can, again, get solid feedback from people. So maybe then I can go even, as you said, continue bootstrapping it until I would need to scale it. Anyway, so I know that I have a good idea. I need to build the MVP. Where I go? Okay, I'll tell you again another story. A guy posted a job on one of the sites similar to Upwork. And he said, you know what? In matter of seconds, not even minutes, I was bombarded. All these messages. By the way, not from individuals only, even from companies who are on these platforms, like Upwork and others. Now, here comes the challenge for me. How do I choose? Okay, you mentioned about the due diligence a little bit, but, you know, like, there are hundreds, thousands over there. So how would I know, and here, how do you help actually in finding the right talent that suits their needs?
That's a great segue to what we do. We found that there was a gap in the market. You know, everyone's inbox, even without having posted a job, your inbox is daily, every day, inundated with people offering their services from around the world, either BDRs and SDRs for go-to-market, or, you know, lead generations, and then obviously software services to build whatever you want to build. And you just, there's just no way you can figure your way through that mess. It's impossible. That's why we built this. Now, Upwork does a pretty good job on gig workers and identifying, you know, previous contracts and recommendations. There are some sites, you have to be very careful about sites that that allow for an advertising listing and they're promoted because they spend more than the other companies. So be very careful about sites like that. In our case, we basically went around, and what's funny is that if you asked any outsourcing engineering firm, hey, if you said, I've got this great idea, it's in fintech, I'm going to build payment rails for blah, 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 can you do it? They'll all say yes, whether they've ever done it or not. And they may have really good leadership in their engineering team that can talk to you in a way that will make you feel like they really get what you're talking about and they understand it and they're going to build it for you. Unfortunately, there's a lot of bait and switch in the interview process and people get lost in that. So even when you do due diligence, it's hard to get the real answers. So we've gone around and we basically asked, look, we represent North American companies who are looking to expand their engineering capacity. And we don't know whether that's going to be 1 or 100 people, but generally that is our client base, and they are looking for good matches. So I want to ask you, if we were to bring you a company to your doorstep, what business would it be in if it was the perfect match? Oh, we do marketplaces. Oh, we do, you know, health tech, and then what kind of marketplace? B2B, B2C. In what domain, like fashion, logistics, what? So we get down to the granular and we tag the companies based on what their number 1, 2, and 3 business experiences have been. Because onboarding, as I described, knowing the rules, the workflows, the business logic of a company's domain really helps quickly onboard them into what you're trying to do, because they don't need to learn all that first part. That's about 3 months of onboarding, basically, if they're starting from scratch. And they can contribute to product while they're building because they know this space. So that's one way that we filter. And then, of course, the other way we filter is domain tech stack. Obviously, that's just table stakes. But we want to know how much bench strength they have in the tech stack, so that if, you know, we bring in 3 or 5 contractors and maybe grows to 10, but one of them, it doesn't work out, we know we've got others within their own bench that we can pull in to replace one that doesn't work out. So we can go longevity with that client, with that vendor. And then the third, probably the most important, but the one that gets the least attention, is culture fit. And, you know, we're dealing with companies from Southeast Asia to, well, we used to deal with Russian companies, but not anymore. But, you know, very diversion cultures and helping, you know, if there's a cultural gap, there's also a communications gap. What does complete mean? What does it mean if I throw something over the fence, is it going to get built in one country, in one culture? In some cultures, absolutely. They'll get the full picture and they'll build it and they'll figure it all out. In other culture, you need a very much more of a waterfall, do this, then do this kind of approach. So that's how we work. And we fit, we don't do really the individual stuff. Like Upwork's pretty good at that. It's not a bad platform for that. But if you need a team, or if you don't need to be with Infosys or, you know, the big Deloitte's and IBM services companies in the middle, which is where most people live, we're the ones who will do all that due diligence and make sure, and bring, we have 80,000 companies in our database. That's probably less than half of the world's engineering firms, which is insane when you think about how many are hitting your inbox. So we bring that down to basically the top 20. And the key that we also look at, of course, is which engineers from that firm, even though the firm's done a lot of business in your space and technically they got the right tech stack, they might not have the right people at the time we're asking. And you don't want them to go looking for them. You want them to have them because that's when you need them. So we also validate the CVs of the people who are actually in the team that is available for the work at the time of asking. There's a lot of great firms that should be on the list, don't make the list because their team isn't available.
Great. So Sean, have you seen any situation where after onboarding these engineers, you know, there's a very good culture fit, there's, you know, some synergy that happens, so they hire them full time? Have you seen something like this?
That is interesting. Actually, we've had a few of those situations, and those are hard to manage. I'm not kidding. It's anathema. It's the opposite of what the engineering firm wants to do. You know, that's a person who's a good engineer. It took them a long time to hire them. They're part of their culture, and they're going to lose that recurring revenue for the rest of that person's career, right? So they have to replace them. So we discourage that immensely. We try and negotiate a longer term, lower cost contract, which also is not really in the interest of the vendor, because they, if that's a good engineer, they can rent that person for a lot higher rate in other places, but better some money than none. And in some cases, a company, you know, people have wanted to quit the company they're working for and go work for the other company, or move to the country, to United States or Canada, as the case may be. In that case, there's nothing we can do about it. We just say, look, let's figure this out. And the key is to have the conversation when it happens, right? Like right. You post an ad, you can't do anything about posting an ad and having one of your contractors answer the ad. That's not, you can't control that. Once that happens, if there's open communications, again, communications and culture and understanding all that is really important. If it's a good relationship, you work it out.
Great. Now, Sean, another thing we started to see, it's not a new concept, but probably I think after pandemic, people started to go to this approach where we, to manage these teams, here a new, it's not new as I said, but you know, the role of the fractional CTO or fractional VP of engineering, let's call it like this, started also to emerge, right?
Yeah.
So do you also provide these kinds, or do you advise your customers to to hire fractional CTOs. And by the way, I have hosted a lot of them on the show. So if they are listening to us today, I'm saying hi. Does that continue or complete, let's say, the full circle of what you're trying to do?
Yeah, I absolutely. Going back to what I said at the very about the startup situation, a fractional CTO is probably the best first thing you can do if you're not a technical expert, because that person should architect the best solution for you and give you that strength without having to get the full time commit of that person. And then maybe that person will also help you build the team and get your first VP of engineering, which would be your team lead to build the product. So you don't necessarily need the CTO day one, but you do need the CTO's experience and mindset, but you don't need it all the time. And that's, I think that's rightfully so, a very important piece of the puzzle. And we use them all the time. And if you have fractional CTOs send me your resumes and your experience, because we do that a lot where we have somebody solution architect for the client. Sometimes it's a refactoring. A lot of companies we deal with are in Series A, Series B funding stage where they've bootstrapped this product, they built it on Ruby and, you know, copied and pasted a bunch of code because they quickly had to get a client on board and stuff like that. Or different areas of the application. And they got sloppy about documentation. I mean, this all happens all the time, but they never address the technical debt because they keep growing. And now they've got investors, and now the investor's saying, hey, you got to really scale this. And you're dealing with more tickets than you are in backlog of new product. So what do you do? Well, you have to continue to support your existing application, but you have to re-architect. And this is where I say that sort of the engineer that got you to where you are might not be the one who gets you to the next step. And it still might be the one who gets you to the next step. But that's where a fractional CTO can come in really strong, who's been there, done that at the higher level, and can advise your engineer that got you to where you are and help re-architect for a much more scalable back end.
And this is actually also the same, theory that all the fractional CTOs I interviewed, they explained to me. Moreover, to your point, Sean, about, you know, which stage they are in. So probably if they have someone in the very early stages, they need to give some equity. They need to give, you know, some, I don't know, stock options, something like that. While they can skip this and avoid further dilution, like for their own ownership in the company. If they maybe, you mentioned like maybe stage A or series A, series B is the most appropriate time to have someone come fully on board and then start to build, because they need to build also not only the engineering team, they would need to build the support team. They need to build a lot of other things also as well. So that makes a lot of sense, right?
Yeah. And if you've had that fractional engineer on your side the whole way, that gives you, going back to the, when investors look at the core team, they'll give the funds to enable you to hire that fractional CTO into a full-time role and give that person the appropriate amount of stock. Because a lot of people, engineers are really good at solving problems, but not necessarily structuring. They're good at architecturing a software, but not necessarily good at architecturing the business. And that's a critical part. And, you know, if you think about it, you give away, like if you're really generous, you want to give 30% of the company to your engineer because you really think that's a great engineer. Well, how much is, if the company's worth $100 million, is the engineer worth $30 million or a couple hundred grand over a couple of years and a little less stock, right? I mean, you have to figure what is your cost of money downstream in that equity give up every time you do those kinds of structures.
Great. Now, Sean, and this is, I'm asking the question because you touched base a little bit on it and you have it now in your company also as well. So AI, you mentioned about Copilot and, you know, a couple of other technologies that are out there. How are you seeing AI playing a role in this whole process? Like whether, you know, helping the founders, you know, internally, let's call it like this, or finding the talent, plus, you know, maybe expediting the whole product to the market. So how are you seeing, you know, AI playing the role here for these companies, especially in the early stage startup companies?
Well, I feel sorry for heads of engineering at any company right now, because you're probably getting higher expectations on productivity and output because of what the CEO or the board is reading about AI and what it can deliver on. And they're asking you also to shave cost out of your engineering budget, and, you know, leverage everything. And it's really hard to keep up. It's changing so fast. But yes, there is unequivocally a accelerated output of productivity in engineering because of AI, not only in terms of writing the original code, but and documenting it. You know, I would say 80% of what we write is with Copilot. It's and you know, great prompt engineering is probably one of the best things you could get to if you're an engineer out there, and you probably already know it anyway. But the so the expectations have risen in the business field for what AI can deliver, but execution is still, you know, it's up to engineers, and engineers have, you know, it's the creative code of an engineer, the creative architecture of engineering is so far hard to replicate. And so I think, you know, there's always going to be room for engineering, and really good engineers. But at the lower end, it's going away. It's definitely going away.
Wow. Like this is, of course, time would show us. But yeah, like definitely AI is, you know, I would say shaking this whole, all industries, but specifically, you know, when it comes to engineering and specifically these roles. So yeah, we'll see how that will evolve in that. I want to go back a little bit, Sean, to the due diligence. I know like you gave some hints over there, but are there like, for example, of course, you know, probably I would ask for what kind of projects these engineers have done before. Maybe I would ask for, you know, maybe their resumes, I don't know. But what I really should be looking at when I'm screening, you know, these companies that I gonna trust them and I gonna give them my, you know, my destiny maybe, because either I will fail or I will succeed because of them. So there must be like some set of questions usually that helps me in doing the due diligence about this company. And there might not be only technology related. So if you can shed some light on that, Sean.
Yeah, no, there's a whole bunch of things. And actually, I'm just about to publish a whole definitive guide on how to outsource. So it's got all the secret questions that we ask. The key is you don't have any time, and you certainly don't want to waste time talking to engineering firms that are a waste of time. And unfortunately, most of them are a waste of time because they either don't have the domain expertise, they don't have the people available, they don't have the people available in the right tech stack. There's a big cultural gap. All these things that cause problems downstream that you only realize after it's too late. So I would say that first, and like I said, most people don't have time, so they don't have good data. Without good data, you can't make a good decision. So you just do a decision based on the short sample that you've got, and you've only got time to say, hey, Mohamed, do you know anybody who's good? And hopefully the person that you refer to has people available and they understand your business. But it's a very slim chance that's actually going to hit. If it does, awesome, go for it. So what key questions can you ask? Well, you would obviously look for proof points that they have had experience in your domain, and you would want to talk to those customers. But before you talk to those customers, here's what I would ask the agency when you're interviewing them. And you're usually interviewing, you're not interviewing the engineers before you've interviewed the company itself. So ask them questions like, you know, what's the churn rate in your company? What's the turnover? Because you don't want to have engaged the company and then find out that, you know, the engineers that you wanted are leaving because there's a better offer at some other company. You want to have longevity of the engineering team. Number two is, all right, so you say you've done this and you're going to show me PowerPoints of all the great results. Great. What happens when shit hits the fan? Like every project has some moment in it where something went bad. And so you want to know how they responded to that. And what you do is you look for how they answer that question, not just what they did, but look at their body language and how they answer it, because you can get a sense of sincerity from it. And then the killer question I love to ask, maybe I should say this on a podcast because people will be listening, but I really like to ask, I say, look, okay, that's great. Fantastic. You answered it really well. You know that I'm doing due diligence. I'm going to ask the customer if that's how it went down. What are they going to say? And then look for the body language. They go, oh God, don't ask my customer. Then you know you're not really dealing with sincerity in the answer in the first place. They just gave you what you wanted to hear. So things like that, you can test the water. But as I say, you know, going from 80,000 companies to two or three is a, you know, in a matter of a couple of weeks is a much more data-driven approach that will avoid all those problems. Honestly, 39% of only 39% of projects are successful in outsourcing because people do the wrong approach. 20% of those unsuccessful are not completely unsuccessful. They're the 20% that have invested so much time and effort trying to get that team to work for them. They just can't afford not to keep going. So they keep going and they finally get it right. But it's so expensive, such a heavy lift. You know, the company is your baby. You know, it's like taking your child to a daycare. You're not going to go to just any daycare you found on the internet. You want to do due diligence and know that it's the right place. So that's the level of thinking you have to go. What would you do, you know, in your due diligence of a daycare? That's what you got to do for the outsourcing company, but you just don't have the time. So data driven is how we approach that problem.
That's fantastic. I like, you know, these questions, I would say, because makes sense to see if they are really telling you the truth, or to your point, they are just making up things. And especially, you know, I didn't see that in engineering specifically, but one thing is indeed you need to ask about the bad moments. Because when it comes to other parts, like maybe lead generation, sales, marketing, like it's easy actually to fake some things. It happened again. It happened to one of my close friends, I would say, where, you know, the guy going to do the testimony for that company. And of course, it was not very hard to figure out that it was like a setup, right?
Right.
Yeah. And if I think you use this approach, it's very useful because you can even catch, you know, such incident where someone is trying to just make up things. So I like this very much, Sean, in this, you know, not only for engineering, for anything when you are hiring someone that you want to outsource things to them.
Sure. That's the tip of the iceberg. There's a whole bunch of stuff I can share. So if you're interested in more, I don't have the guide yet available, but go to our website, sign up and ask for the guide. I'll make sure you
Absolutely.
Outforce.ai.
Yeah, of course, we're going to put that, at the, you know, in the show notes. So now back to the geographies and locations. Mm. How, first, where are now the best talents in your opinion? Where are they? And other than the cultural differences and nuances like you just mentioned, do you think like sometimes time zones might be also another showstopper for companies to hire these engineering companies?
100%. No. So, I get a lot of people asking me that question: where are the best engineers, or what's the best value? And you can't answer that question based on a country. It's like saying, I want to build a hockey team. I'm going to throw a dart in Canada. I'm a skier. So you pick a Canadian, you're not going to necessarily get a hockey player. So picking a country, terrible way to find an engineering team, except that you might find a cultural, there's less cultural barriers between you and the country that you're thinking about. But just about every country in the world has dealt with most of the mature companies in any country in the world have had American clients or Canadian clients or British or, you know, European clients. They've had enough international experience that they've done some bridging of the cultural gaps. The answer about engineering, you know, it really depends on who's available at the time and that are the right fit. So it's not a geographic question. What we do is we start off with, what are your time constraints? Like, is it important that they are in the same time zone? Boom, we eliminate most of the world, and we sit within what we say, what's the halo you're willing to work with? As in, can you live with 2 hours difference, 4 hours difference? So you've got a halo where there's enough overlap on engineering teams working together. That sort of is the parameter. Then what are your cost limitations? That's another parameter. But generally, we suggest looking at cost after submissions because, as you know, an engineer that might be $35 an hour might be a great price, but an engineer that is $65 an hour might do four times as much in an hour as a $35 an hour engineer. So, you know, productivity is what you're really looking for, and experience and, you know, critical thinking and communication styles, all those things I think are more important than price until you get down to, you know, four or five options that are all equal on all those respects. Then you look at price and a relative time zone, cultural gap, and finalize your choice. But you can't say best engineers are in Ukraine or in Siberia or in Serbia. There are tons of really good ones. Like, honestly, you know, one of the best things the USSR gave was engineering education. Country that has been under Russian communist rule previously has a legacy of phenomenal mathematics and phenomenal engineering mindset.
Absolutely.
But that is also true of Brazil and Argentina and other companies, a country and Uruguay and Colombia. All these countries in South and Latin America are also really coming up. Vietnam, fantastic, but big cultural gap, hard language gap. You know, people think of India as, you know, the legacy mindset of India is, oh, really low cost engineering. No, people coming out of IITs in India are getting paid 250 grand without having worked a day because they're the smartest people in India. There's a lot of people in India. So you have one fraction of 1% of the people get into IITs. Man, Facebook, Google, they're all lined up at the door to get those people. So great engineers are available. They're just not equally distributed. They are in certain pockets around the world, but there's a lot of pockets.
I love this approach, Sean. And again, I want to repeat this. Don't go for the cheapest because, of course, I understand you're bootstrapping, you're trying to still build, but at the end of the day, you don't need to do the work twice. And I have seen people who've paid double and triple because they were focusing only on cost. And I'm not saying that because sometimes someone is cheap, that means they are bad. Like probably like some of them, they want to prove themselves. So maybe the first project they get involved with, they're, you know, willing to give that extra mile of discounting their prices because they want you to become a reference for them. But yeah, like to your point, of course, you should look at productivity, quality, of course, of the work also as well, because I've seen people struggling you know, and not coding, by the way. I'm talking about simple UI design, UX design, and these kinds of things. So you need someone to understand what you're trying to achieve so they can implement it also in the most effective way. So 100% on that, Sean.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
Because, Sean, you are into this space and you get all these requests and, you know, you facilitate, you know, between companies and the engineering firms that offer these services. Are you seeing a certain trend currently, like people are willing to do more of, I don't know, fintech, HR tech? Like, where are you seeing the most demand coming from?
I would say health tech and fintech are very strong growth sectors, especially health tech. You know, SaaS businesses are always there, but they tend to start small and hire their own engineering teams until they get to something really big. But yeah, I would say the two high growth sectors are fintech and health tech. Prop tech is slowly coming up. And then, you know, digital transformation, ETL grunt work, I would describe it as, is an ongoing business. There's still so many, you know, non-technical businesses that are recognizing the value of data or recognizing that their legacy systems need to be refactored. And so that will never, that just seems to never end. So those are the sectors I'd say are the strongest.
Yeah, by the way, it's same here in my area in Dubai and in the broader, I would say, Middle East or Middle East, North Africa region. So fintech is on the rise. Next comes HR tech. Little bit of ed tech, education technology. Prop tech, for some reasons, also it's picking up because everything is real estate here, and, you know, and there are a lot of investment in that area. So prop tech is coming up. I wish to see more deep tech. I wish to see more B2B SaaS. I wish to see more digital transformation. It's there, but as you mentioned, you know, this, the same story seems everywhere. And I think, you know, people to focus more on the value of the data at the end of the day. Sean, as we are close to an end, two things I want to ask you very quickly. Your final thoughts, final maybe advice you want to give for anyone who is considering outsourcing today. And the other one, which is, I know it's written here, but again, where people can find more about you and about your company.
Well, you can look me up on LinkedIn for sure, or Sean at outforce.ai. And then in terms of final thoughts, I mean, look, if you're starting a business, go fast. Speed, we talked about cost in engineering. I always tell my clients, look, it's a trilemma. You can go with cost, speed, or quality, but you can't pick all three. It's two, right? And so we solve for cost. We don't solve for cost. We solve for quality and speed, and we will get you the right team fast. But cost comes as a third and a very distant third, as I described. And I recommend that for everybody else is you should look at how fast do you need to build up your team, but focus primarily on quality. Because as you said, you don't want to waste time rewriting. If it's well-architected and set up in the right way in the first place with a fractional CTO or a partner, then you're set up way, you'll just solve a lot of problems downstream that you don't want when you're growing.
Absolutely. And just to the point for people who are technical, you will understand what I'm saying, because Sean, you repeated it a couple of times, technical depth. And actually the previous episode with Noah Crenton, it was about that specifically because he's a tech leadership coach. So it makes your headaches in the future, you know, technical depth is on when you grow, you need to deal with it. So it's better to avoid that early stage, to your point, you know, avoiding changing teams a lot, bring a good quality team, even outsource to what we were discussing today. So that's absolutely, you know, something very advisable, I would say. So, and yeah, you know, you reminded me of this. I'm not sure if when the last time I've seen this, you know, the famous meme about, you know, project, and you know, you can pick three, you need to pick two out of three, and then, you know, the fast and the cheap, and then you have the good quality, but slow. So yeah, I believe what you mentioned resonates, especially for startups, because you need to be fast and you need to have quality at the same time. So, but this is, of course, would not be cheap, which is
it doesn't have to not be cheap. I mean, it's not going to be cheap. It's, it just doesn't have to be, it doesn't have to be expensive either though.
And no, that's the advantage of outsourcing. Absolutely. Yeah. Like, I mean, like not cheap in the sense, I mean, like zero, of course. But yeah, so these are the two things they need to focus on, is quality and speed, because if they are not getting good quality products, their competition would get them there. And if they are not shipping fast, again, the same thing, they would be left behind. So
absolutely,
you know, it makes sense.
And
Sean, please.
Before you go, you talked about technical debt. One of the ways to avoid technical debt is to be disciplined in your sprints. And every 6 months, do a 2-week sprint that is not new product. It's technical debt.
Yeah.
Just, you know, if you don't factor it into your life cycle of engineering, it will just build up and build up, and it will be the bane of your existence. You'll be firefighting instead of building.
Absolutely. Again, like I've seen a lot of stories around technical debt. So yeah, perfectly said, Sean. Well, Sean, you know, I really enjoyed the conversation, and
me too.
I hope, you know, you know, we can do another maybe episode in the future, because this topic can go for hours and hours and hours. So, yeah, thank you for all your insights you gave today. I'm very happy because we touched, I believe, on majority of the points that founders, they need to think about, especially we discussed about they should not be afraid of, you know, giving the work to an outsourced company. We discussed, you know, about what are the things they need to take care of, the due diligence, the quality of, you know, the skills that they need to look at, and all this stuff. And of course, what we discussed at the end. So, you know, I really, as I said, thank you very much for all these insights. People can find more on outforce.ai. And I'm going to put this also in the show notes. And this is usually how I end my episodes. So this is for the audience. If you just discovered this podcast now, thank you very much for passing by. I hope you enjoyed. Please, if you do, subscribe and share it with your friends and colleagues. And if you are one of the loyal followers who keep, you know, listening to us and keep sending us their comment, thank you very much. Keep them coming. And also, as I mentioned in every episode end, if you are interested in coming to the show because you are doing something different, you're helping startups anyway or another, you have a great idea, you're trying to build it, and you want some push to get it out to the world, don't hesitate to reach out to me. We can make it. Time zones is not an issue. Sean is in Canada, I'm in Dubai, so we can still arrange for a time. I even had guests in New Zealand, which is like, you know, on the other side of the world, I would say, and we still did it. So reach out, don't be shy. Thank you very much for tuning in, and we will be again with you in a new episode. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Hit that subscribe button. Share the show with your tech-savvy friends and fellow entrepreneurs. And leave us a review on your favorite podcast app. Your support means the world to us.